back. It shouldn't have surprised me. When you look like Hugh, all you have to do is leave the house and people will approach you, especially gay men, the dogs. His handsomeness was never my personal opinion. Rather, like the roundness of the earth, it is something society generally agrees upon. Without my face to use as bait, I had to work a lot harder than he did. There are times, I'll admit, when I had to beg. That said, some of Hugh's earlier choices seemed poorly thought out to me, especially once AIDS came along. 35, 36. Every man ticked off on his fingers was someone I'd been compared to at one point or another. Not overtly, he's anything but cruel, but surely it happened. Someone kissed better than I did, someone had more stamina, a more seductive voice, bigger muscles. I'm confident enough to compete against a dozen of his exes, but he was moving on to the population of a small town. 38, 39. By what miracle had neither of us contracted AIDS? How had we gotten away? I don't just mean later, when people knew to be safe, but back in the days when it didn't have a name and no one understood how it spread. One of the men Hugh had lived with, a professor he had his first year of college, had died of it in the late 80s, and surely there were others on both my side and his. Yet, for some reason, we'd escaped, had prospered even. Now, here we were, the shadows lengthening, our spaghetti growing cold, as he hit the half-hundred mark, then blithely sailed beyond it. Whore. Sorry. When she was young, my sister-in-law Kathy had a kitten named Snowy. She was white, of course, she said one evening over the sorry board at our house on Emerald Isle. I've never been much for games, but this one I can play all night. Half of it is luck, and the rest is ruthlessness. You have to be cold, so my niece Madeline, who is 12 and has a heart made of frozen concrete, usually wins. She was just the prettiest thing, Kathy continued, watching as I shuffled the deck for another round. Then she swallowed a fish hook. I set the cards in the center of the board. Yikes! Tell me about it, Kathy said. It didn't seem like there was any way to fix her, so my mom told my brother to hold her down. She took a sip of her bourbon. Then she shot her in the head. Maddie, who had no doubt heard this story before, gathered the bright plastic pawns in her hands and turned to her mother, asking, "What color do you want?" Kathy considered her options and sighed. "I'll go with the red." Whenever I doubt the wisdom of buying a beach house, all I have to do is play a round of sorry, and it all seems worth it. For starters, it's the only time Madeline will really talk. Wiping the floor with everyone around her eases what is otherwise a crippling shyness and brings her fully to life. Ask her a question on the beach and the most you're likely to get is a shrug. At the board, on the other hand, she'll tell you anything. Is chatty, almost. Before getting the C-section, I didn't have much contact with my brother's family. I'd see them in Raleigh when I passed through town every other year. I'd send cards and letters, but that was about it. Were it not for sorry, I'd never have known that Kathy's mother shot a kitten in the head. Now that's a sister-in-law, I thought. She drew a one, and I watched as she moved the first of her four pawns from the starting position. Then she whispered softly to me and her daughter, "I will destroy the both of you." We usually play sorry in the living room on the east side of the house while sitting on the floor around the coffee table. Getting a game together is the easiest thing in the world. Only four at a time can play, but there will often be others on the sidelines, coaching. Paul, for instance. When his daughter's at the board, he'll take a knee and lean in. "Come on, him, baby, go for the throat, just like Daddy taught you. It's hard to get ahead in this game without occasionally sending a fellow player back to start. Sorry, you say, sincerely at first, and then in a way that means, I'm sorry you're the sort of person who deserves this. Madeline will take any opportunity to screw someone over. She's like her grandmother, shooting a kitten in the head, heartless. The Christmas that Paul brought his family to Sussex, she presented me with a sorry game of my own, and though we pulled it out a dozen or so times, it never felt urgent the way it does at the beach. After they left, I played only once with a friend of Hugh's named Candy. You sort of need the sound of the waves in order to get in the proper mood, I said, putting the board away after I had crushed her. Another thing I love about the beach is sitting in the sun, mainly for the lazy kind of talk it generates. A person can say anything with lotion on, and I'm more than willing to listen. Most people, myself included, have moved on to sunblock, but not my sister Gretchen, who is outdoors a lot and usually arrives at the start of our vacation the burnished chestnut of a well-worn saddle. This is a woman who tans the spaces between her fingers, who lies on the beach with her mouth open so she can darken the front of her uvula. She's starting to look like one of those dolls made from a dried apple, not that it bothers her any. My sister is one of the few women I know who doesn't dye her hair or bemoan the fact that she's getting older. She embraces her impending decrepitude. Gretchen's birthday falls in early August, and the year she turned 55, we celebrated it together on Emerald Isle. Paul, Kathy, and Madeline were there briefly, as was Hugh, his mother Joan, and his sister Anne, who is my age and has three grown children. She and Hugh could be twins, that's how alike they look, both tall and slender with big teeth, just shy of Kennedy size. Their mother is a lot smaller and wispy. Joan is 83 now, pale as a light bulb, with white hair cut bluntly at her jawline. She recently replaced her wire-rimmed glasses. The new ones have heavy black frames and lend her a studious, almost owlish demeanor, which is fitting, as she's always got her nose in a book. The writers she prefers are long dead and were on the wordy side. If the novel on the sofa is 700 pages long and the author photo is an engraving, it's either hers or Hugh's. One of the differences between his family and my own is the way we'll listen to a story. It's hard to finish more than a few sentences at a time when talking to his mother, who likes to interrupt, either to accuse you of exaggerating, oh, now, that's not true, or to defend the person you're talking about, someone, most often, she has never met. A stranger could hit me across the face with a sawed-off table leg, then kick me until my spinal column snapped, and still Joan would say, well, I'm sure he meant well. My family, on the other hand, is always happy to hear about how horrible someone is. You could wake any of my sisters from a sound sleep, say, you won't believe what this asshole said to me once in 1979, and have her full attention. Not Joan, though, or her daughter either. Tell Anne that you want the renters two doors down, the ones who blast country music from their boombox and howl, yee-haw, every 2 minutes, to die, and she'll say, you should never wish ill on people. That's bad karma. Around the Hamricks, you can't even denigrate sharks, which were on everyone's mind in the summer of 2015. By the time we arrived, they had attacked 8 swimmers, most of them in shallow water. People were canceling their vacation rentals, and it got even worse after 2 kids, one age 12 and the other 16, had their arms bitten off. Yes, well, the sharks didn't eat those arms, Hugh said when I brought it up. To him, this somehow made it better, though I didn't see it that way at all. In fact, it made it worse. Why dismember young people for no reason? Besides, Hugh said, I go out far when I swim. Right, but in order to get to where it's deep, you sort of have to pass through the shallow part. But I can do that quickly, he argued. Anyway, sharks don't want me, they want fish. It was clear I was wasting my breath. I said to Gretchen, I just pray they get his left arm instead of his right one. That way he can still kind of cook. You can issue all the warnings you like, but nothing will keep a hamrick out of the ocean. She's frail, Hugh's mother, a bit wobbly now, yet twice a day her children would lead her beyond the waves, one at each elbow, steadying her until they reached the calm water. Then they'd let go, and the three of them would swim for an hour at a time. Gretchen and I watched them from the shore one afternoon, me gessoed with sunblock, and her glistening with what may have been bacon fat. The sight of Joan backstroking off into the distance made us think of our own mother. She would wade knee-deep in the ocean if she were fishing, but we never saw her go any further. Even at the country club, the most she'd do was stick her feet in the kiddie pool. She didn't know how to swim. No one ever taught her. Plus, said Gretchen, she didn't want to get her hair wet. Time spent underwater would have been less time our mother had to observe people and discuss their shortcomings in a group setting. She even did it to us, her own children. You won't believe what Lisa's done this time, she'd whisper to me in the kitchen or living room, her cigarette stalled an inch from her mouth while this much more important business took place. Being her confidant made me feel special. Only she and I could truly understand how stupid the people in my family were. The downside, I discovered, was that no one was safe. It was hurtful the first few times her criticism got back to me. I don't know who he thinks he's fooling with that Raquel Welch poster. Then I realized that it didn't mean anything. Opinions constantly shifted and evolved, were fluid the same way thoughts were. 10 minutes into The Exorcist, you might say, this is boring. An hour later, you could decide that it was the best thing you'd ever seen, and it was no different with people. The villain at 3 in the afternoon might be the hero by sunset. It was all just storytelling. Try explaining that to a hamrick, though. After I die and you read something bad about yourself in my diary, do yourself a favor and keep reading, I often say to Hugh. I promise that on the next page you'll find something flattering. Or maybe the page after that. Now I stood and waved to him out in the water. As I sat back down, Gretchen reached for her iPod and told me about a group of teenagers she recently ran into at the grocery store near her house. They were 14, maybe 15 years old, laughing and pushing each other. Just awful, right? So I went over and told them to shut up. I took off my shirt and balled it up for use as a pillow. Wow, I know it, Gretchen said. Normally I wouldn't have gotten involved. Then, of course, they wound up behind me in line, still loud and obnoxious, and almost like there was someone else inhabiting my body, I turned around and said, did I not tell you to shut the fuck up? Then what happened, I asked. She lit a cigarette and shrugged. They shut the fuck up. That night at the sorry board, Kathy told me that she and Madeline had stopped by the pier earlier in the day and watched as people fed the sharks. There must have been 10 of them, some as long as 5 feet, she said. Are you hearing this? I called to Hugh. He was sitting on the porch with his mother and sister, no doubt recalling the time they'd chased a hippo from their tennis court back when they lived in the Congo. God, those hamricks can reminisce. Kathy saw 25 sharks, some of them 12 feet long, at the pier this afternoon. Now that's not true, Joan said. Even if she did see them, the pier is at least a mile from here, Hugh added. Sharks do this thing called swimming, I told him. A mile is nothing to them. I turned to Madeline, who had drawn a 10, and instead of moving forward like a normal, sweet sixth grader, employed the card's other option and took one step back, thereby returning my pawn to start, though I posed no threat to her whatsoever. You will grow up to be a terrible person, I told her. I mean more terrible than you are now, if that's even possible. He didn't mean that, Joan called from out on the porch. My goal on this beach trip was to find the snapping turtle I'd befriended the previous summer and feed him the lipoma I'd had cut out of me in El Paso. It had been in the freezer for 9 months now, in a Ziploc bag with David's tumor written on it. Every day I'd go down to the canal and stand on the narrow footbridge. The snapper I was searching for was as big as my rolling suitcase and had a hideous growth, a little top hat of flesh cocked just so on his head. There was no mistaking him for anyone else. That's what I liked about him. He had style. I mentioned him at the sorry board, and Madeline, not caring that I'd called her a terrible person, said, "Didn't Daddy tell you? That turtle is dead." It seems she and Paul had gone looking for him earlier in the summer and were given the news by the man who lives beside the bridge and who had apparently found the body, so there went that. Still, there was no reason to let a perfectly good lipoma go to waste, and so I went in search of another candidate. The one I chose lurks behind a shopping plaza. A lot of turtles congregate there, not just snappers, but sliders as well, because vacationers feed them. There's a coin-operated machine that dispenses what looks like dried dog food, so kids will buy a fistful and drop the pellets piece by piece into the water 10 feet below. Others skip the dispenser and toss in their leftovers from the two nearby restaurants, French fries, onion rings, pizza crusts. The turtles will eat anything. The day I brought out my defrosted tumor, a dozen or so people were gathered around the railing. I reached into my Ziploc bag, realizing as I did so that what I was touching was myself, or what used to be myself. The egg-sized lipoma had been diced into 10 or so pieces and was greasy and blood-soaked, not like anything I'd put my hands on before. I threw a dollop to the fiercest of the 5 snapping turtles idling amongst the pylons, and he ate it with gusto. Then I threw in another bit, and another after that. Beside me stood a pot-bellied man in a baseball cap. His shirt had short sleeves and was unbuttoned almost to the waist. "I don't know what you're feeding that guy, but he's sure loving it." I nodded. He looked at my Ziploc bag. "What is that, by the way?" I emptied the last few bits, and realizing how complicated it would be to answer my tumor, I said instead, "Nothing much, just some raw chicken." I brought a damp paper towel to wash my hands with, but my lipoma was messier than I'd anticipated, so I went to the Food Lion that's attached to the shopping center to buy some wet wipes. The store was crowded with vacationers, renters who, grocery-wise, were having to start from scratch. Salt and pepper, cooking oil, aluminum foil, ketchup. Carts were heaped. I got into the express line behind a middle-aged man in a T-shirt. I never saw the front of it, but the back pictured a Labrador retriever standing on the beach with a bikini top in his mouth. Below him were the words, "Good dog." "Some people," I thought, opening the wet wipe so I could wash the tumor off my hands before I touched my wallet. Over a game of sorry that night, I told Kathy and Madeline about the turtle I'd thrown my lipoma to. I had 4 pawns on the board, more than anyone else, but it was too early to start gloating. Fortunes can reverse in a matter of seconds, especially when my niece is around. "I thought I'd be able to feed him a kidney as well, but it fell through," I said, praying as my sister-in-law reached for a card that it wouldn't have the word "sorry" written on it. Kathy drew a useless 12. "A kidney from a dog or cat?" "No," I said, "from a human teenager." Madeline drew a 1 and released the first of her 4 pawns from the starting gate. It was a teenager. "A 16-year-old I met in Albuquerque last spring," I said. The two of us got to talking, and when I asked if he was getting a summer job, he said no, that after school got out, he'd be checking into the hospital. One of his kidneys was dead inside him, so he was going to have it removed. Kathy looked up and frowned. "Poor guy." "There was something special about him," I told her. "He was funny and remarkably articulate for someone his age. I asked if he had an iPad, and when he told me no, I said, 'Well, you do now. I'm buying you one so you can use it in the hospital.'" "Wow," Kathy said. "That was really nice of you." "Wasn't it?" I took a moment to feel good about myself. In exchange, he promised me his dead kidney, though I knew it was a long shot. Goddamn doctors. I understand not giving him the entire thing. It would be a lot to carry. But the least they could have done was break off a corner. I don't think kidneys have corners, Madeline said. Don't be such a know-it-all, I told her. It's a really bad trait for a child. I think back on this exchange the following day, after I'd repeated the story about the iPad to Hugh's mother. You're not supposed to talk about your good deeds, I know. It effectively negates them, and in the process makes people hate you. If there's a disaster, for instance, and someone tells me he donated $5,000 to the relief effort, this while I gave a lesser amount or nothing at all, I don't think, goodness, how big-hearted you are, but rather, fuck you for making me look selfish. That said, Hugh's mother could have given me a little more credit. What I got instead was, you bought a brand new iPad for some kid you don't even know? Now that's just showing off. Now hold on a minute, I said. If you really want to help someone, you should think about those Syrian refugees, she continued. I know, but I see them on TV, some of them drowning, their children dead, and it just tears me apart. That's who you should be reaching out to, not some American who probably has a car and who knows what else. Syria, like Kosovo before it, was one of those stories that started while I wasn't paying attention, or rather, while I was paying attention to something else, a celebrity wedding, perhaps. Then, all of a sudden, it was everywhere, and I felt it was too late to get into it. The teenager, on the other hand, was right in front of me. Doing something nice for him was easy and immediate. It didn't lead to the mountain of junk mail you're punished with whenever you give to an established charity. We had lunch on the deck that afternoon, a salad with shrimp in it. As Hugh brought it to the table, his sister recounted the flight she and Joan had taken from Louisville. There was nothing much to her story. She'd asked the woman to swap seats so she could sit beside her mother, and the woman, quite logically, to my mind, said no. All I do is fly, so one-upping Anne was pretty easy. A few years back, at a book signing, I met a pilot, I began. He flew the Newark to Palm Beach route, right? So it's December 23rd, and as they touch down in Florida, one of the flight attendants takes the microphone and delivers her standard landing speech. Please remain seated until the fasten seat belt sign has been turned off, and be careful when opening the overhead bins. We'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas, and to those of you already standing, Happy Hanukkah. Joan put down her fork. Oh, now, she didn't say that. Why not? I asked. Because it's prejudiced. Of course it is, but that doesn't mean she didn't say it. Well, that's just nonsense, Joan continued. That never happened. The pilot was just pulling your leg. I hate being challenged over a story someone told me. Really? I asked. And you know him? Were you there? No, but, so actually, I said, my heart racing as I pushed myself away from the table, you have no idea what you're talking about, do you? Hugh's opening line when scolding me afterward in the privacy of our bedroom was, how dare you talk to my mother that way? I tried to explain why it had so bothered me, and he cut me off. What's it like to know that the best part of yourself just got fed to a snapping turtle? I then reminded him of the time my father came for Christmas. It was 1998 in Normandy, and you told him to get the fuck out of your kitchen. Hugh crossed his arms. Again, you're wrong. What I said was, I need for you to get the fuck out of my kitchen. That's not better, I said. It's just longer. He insisted I apologize to his mother, and then he stomped into the storage room in search of something, his cloak of self-righteousness, maybe. After he'd left, I changed into my bathing suit and joined my sister on her beach blanket. It was early afternoon, hot and bright. Gretchen was wearing a fudge-colored tankini that disappeared against her skin and made it look like she was naked. Is that the swimsuit you bought the time we went to Hawaii together? I asked, still stinging from my most recent arguments. Joan was right, of course. I had been showing off. But so what? A truly decent kid got an iPad out of it. It made him happy, and if it made me happy to tell a few dozen people about it, or, okay, a few thousand, what was the harm? As for the story the pilot told me, why would he have made it up? Why does everything that counters Joan's worldview have to be false? Bad things happen. People are discriminated against and tortured. Kittens swallow fish hooks and get shot in the head. I'm not saying you should dwell solely on the negative, but why blot it out entirely, especially in a social setting where it's practically your duty to spark debate and lively conversation? Then, too, why am I always the one to apologize? It wouldn't kill me to return to the house and say I'm sorry, but I couldn't have said it with any conviction. It would, in fact, make me the liar I'd just been accused of being. And how was that fair? The people two doors down who'd been playing country music since we arrived had left, finally. Just as I was appreciating how quiet it was, a rescue helicopter appeared from the sound side of the island and soared off over the water, perhaps looking for a drowning victim or some poor swimmer who'd been mauled by a shark. It's beautiful, the Atlantic, but at the same time so insistent, always advancing, always taking what it wants. When the helicopter eventually disappeared over the horizon, I meant to recount my recent battles with Hugh and his mother, to tap into the comfort and outrage that only my family can provide. But just as I opened my mouth, Gretchen sat up and said, lazily, almost like someone who was talking in her sleep, "Do you remember my old boyfriend, Greg?" "Sure." She lit a cigarette and took a deep draw. "He used to drink the liquid out of tuna cans." The story of my argument was insignificant now, dwarfed by this larger and infinitely more fascinating topic. I let go of my anger, all of it, and leaned back on the beach blanket, feeling palpably lighter, giddy almost, feeling related. "Oil or water?" I asked. Gretchen leaned back as well and brought her cigarette to her sun-blistered lips. "Both." Boo-hooey. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's people talking about ghosts. You wouldn't think it would be that much of a problem. Who are you hanging out with, for God's sake, someone might ask. Camp counselors? But even friends I thought of as normal have something to say when the talk, as it invariably does, turns to haunted houses or apartments or dorm rooms or secondhand suitcases. Leading the charge is usually Hugh. Don't get him started on the farmhouse he and his family lived in after returning to the United States in the late 1970s, or you'll never hear the end of it. And if his mother's in the room at the same time, run. Though they sometimes argue over whether this particular ghost was wearing a red dress or a blue one with tiny checks, they're generally in accord over her haunting style. She wasn't a chain rattler, she wasn't aggressive, but neither did she keep out of sight. "The poor thing," Hugh's mother says, "trapped between one world and the next, it can't be easy." "There must be spirits in your house," people say, when they visit Hugh and me in England. "A place this old has got to be crawling with them." "Nope," I say. "Sorry." I thought the ghosts these people were referring to would have died in one of the bedrooms. A consumptive child, maybe, or a grandmother with buckshot wounds. But according to my sister Amy, who heard it from a reliable source, spirits can just as easily be brought in. "They travel in antiques sometimes," she said. "Like dressers and corner cupboards?" I asked. "Or picture frames or candlesticks," she explained. "They can attach themselves to just about anything. That's why a lot of people won't wear vintage clothes." I thought she was making this up, but it's a real thing, apparently. Dry cleaning doesn't kill them? I asked. They're not bed bugs, Amy said. They're ghosts. Hugh claims the reason I've never seen one is that I'm not perceptive enough. This is his way of telling me that I'm self-centered, suggesting that if I weren't so concerned about, for example, meeting my daily Fitbit goal, I'd realize there's a 600-year-old milkmaid living in our silverware drawer. He's saying that he, his mother, and all the other people who detect flickering shadows on their bedroom walls are special in a way that I am not. And what about people who see pixies, I ask. Well, they're just crazy, Hugh says. If there are no ghosts in your home or office, if your parking deck and tool shed are spirit-free, you don't have to feel left out. There are any number of places that advertise themselves as haunted, inns and such. Did you see Headless Hazel? The owners ask over breakfast, no doubt silently chuckling as guests cry, I did. She was at the end of the hall when we came up from dinner last night, stabbing a doll with a knitting needle. I refuse to support the poltergeist industry, so would sooner sleep in a cardboard box than at the Belgrove Plantation or the Albert Chafsky House or any of the other places listed in the 100 Most Haunted Hotels and B&Bs in America, none of which is named the Scariot for some reason. The number two thing I can't stand hearing about are dreams. How did you sleep? I'll sometimes ask you. If his answer has anything to do with piloting a plane made of meat or handing a poker chip the size of a trash can lid to a sea lion with Yoko Ono's face, I'll either put my fingers in my ears or walk out of the room. All that said, I do believe the dead can visit us in our sleep, though not in anything I'd call a dream, and not in a form I'd consider in any way ghostly. Take my mother, for instance. Every time I see her, she's seated at a table in an otherwise empty room. She is never outlandishly dressed. She's not transparent or oversized or tiny. The tone of our visits is almost formal. She asks how things are going, and I answer the same way I would if I were awake. Like, for example, when I quit smoking, she wondered what was new, and I held up my empty hand. Wow, she said, noticing the cigarette that wasn't there. How'd you do that? The longest she ever quit was for 2 weeks. I just wasn't strong enough to put it behind me, she said. Well, I told her, don't beat yourself up over it. I suppose it was all part of what made you, you. In our visits, my mother is only 62, the age she was when she died. At the time, that seemed old to me, though now, of course, I'm almost there myself. Before I know it, she and I will be contemporaries. Then I'll overtake her, and how strange will that be? To have a mother young enough to be my daughter. When that day comes, will I think her naive? What do you know about being old, I'll ask, me with white hair or, likelier still, bald? You never even reached retirement age. Already there's so much she's missed out on. Email, ISIS, reality TV, my niece Madeline. I have to watch what I say, otherwise I spend half my visit explaining what something is. They're pictures you take of yourself with a phone and send to the people you no longer communicate with by talking. When it's time for my mother to go, she stands up and brushes her hands on her skirt. Sometimes she has a big beige purse with her and sometimes not. Her hair is always done. She's made up and has her octagonal glasses on. We hug and then she leaves, not eagerly but not regretfully either. It's the same with Tiffany, though she tends to stand rather than sit. My sister was never what you'd call a big listener, but in my sleep she's all ears. Really? She'll say. And then what? In fact, we never talk about her, just me. That's how you know it's a dream, Amy says. But it's not. It's real. I'm not alone in this. It happens to other people as well. And unlike with a nightmare or a ghost story, I don't mind hearing about it. I talked to my dad last night. He will tell me at least once a year. Give me the details, I'll say, as I liked his father. Sam could be intimidating, but he was an original thinker when it came to politics. Did he talk about the election, I'll ask? Oh, he must be furious. I can never predict when Tiffany or my mother will show up. I can't conjure them, nor can I control how long they stay. The following morning I'll feel content, recharged. When I think of Mom or my sister the day after a visit, I remember only the good times and wish it could always be this way. I don't like recalling their faults or the arguments we had, though with my mother there were only a handful, and they were usually over within an hour or so. I wonder if, after I'm dead, I'll be able to visit people the way my mother and sister can. It's nice to think I could drop in on Hugh and tell him to keep his chin up. I've told him 1,000 times that after I'm gone he needs to find himself a new boyfriend. I've even identified some. The first two, okay, maybe I didn't put enough thought into them. Are you kidding? Hugh said when I pointed out Gilles. Him? Well, he speaks French, I said. That's not enough to make me want him, for God's sake. I mean, he wears aftershave. The second was a wrong move as well. Way too finicky. But he is good-looking, I said. What do I want with a good-looking boyfriend? Hugh asked. Right, I said. Thanks. The latest one, though, a sheep farmer named Duncan, this time I'm really on to something. It's true that he's currently living with somebody, but at this point so is Hugh. There's no telling what might happen between now and when I die, I say. Maybe Duncan's boyfriend will hit me with his car while driving drunk. I'll be killed instantly, he'll be sent to prison for manslaughter, and wham, the two of you are set. I believe I'm being thoughtful, but Hugh doesn't see it that way. In fact, it infuriates him. Don't you want me to be happy after you die? I ask. No, he says, I want you to be alone and miserable, and if you do find someone, I'm going to return from the dead and haunt you. This brings us back to ghosts, which, as I said, I don't believe in. I'm just too practical. A number of reasons I've been depressed lately. 1. It's early September 2015, and I'm on the island of Santorini for a literary festival. After the short reading, which takes place outdoors on a patio, the Greek audience asks questions, the first of which is, what do you think of Donald Trump? Since announcing his candidacy, the reality show star has been all over the news. Every outrageous thing he says is repeated and analyzed, like he's a real politician. I answer that I first became aware of Donald Trump in the late 1980s. That was when Alma, a Lithuanian woman I was working for, bought his book, The Art of the Deal, and decided that he was wonderful. Shortly afterward, I saw him on Oprah, and ever since then he's always been in the background, this ridiculous blowhard, part showman and part cartoon character. I see his presidential bid as just another commercial for himself. It wouldn't surprise me if he were to name the Hamburglar as his running mate. So I say that on stage, and then have to explain who the Hamburglar is. 2. A month before the election, a man picks me up at the Philadelphia airport and takes me to Red Bank, New Jersey for a show. We get to talking, and I learn that his name is Michael. He is white and 55 and used to work for Pathmark, a supermarket chain that went bankrupt and closed the last of its branches in 2015. I ask some general questions and learn that grocery stores make the bulk of their money on junk food. The highest markup, though, is on spices, 76%, Michael says, adding that the most frequently stolen items are razor blades, baby formula, and big jugs of laundry detergent, which seem like they'd be pretty hard to shoplift. I mean, those things have gotten huge, like gas cans. Nowadays, people walk out with a whole cart, Michael says. Roll out the door, saying, just try and stop me. It's rare for a hired driver to overtly discuss politics, and rarer still for him or her to introduce the topic. They will sometimes skirt around it, though. We pass a Trump sign on the road, and Michael acknowledges it, saying sourly, I just feel that for guys like us, white guys our age, if we need any help, housing or food stamps or whatever, it's the back of the line. You know what I mean? Well, isn't that sort of where the line forms, I think? Michael is in a group I've been hearing a lot about lately. White men who, following 8 years of a black president, feel forgotten. How exactly did Obama neglect you, I want to ask, but don't. Instead, I changed the subject to lines in general. I didn't wait more than a few minutes to check in for my flight this morning, I say cheerfully, not adding that I'm executive platinum on American, so never have to wait for anything. When I do have to wait, I'm appalled. 3. I donate $1,000 to the Hillary for President campaign, and within what seems like minutes, I get an email from them saying, in effect, "That's great, but can we have more?" Her organization is by no means unique in this regard. Everyone I donate to acts the same way, and I wind up unsubscribing from their emails and resenting them. 4. I talk to a longtime friend of the family who tells me with great authority that Hillary Clinton is a member of the Illuminati, and that she and her husband have killed scores of people, including children, whom they also sexually molested. "You're kidding, right?" I say. He's not. And within minutes, words are shooting from his mouth like water from a fire hose. It's hard to catch them all, but I do grab hold of, "You think it's a coincidence that Prince was murdered on Queen Elizabeth's birthday?" "Who said that he was murdered?" I ask. "Oh, please," this person says. "You honestly believe he died of an accidental drug overdose?" The guy speaks to me like I'm an idiot. "And the Queen had him killed. Why, exactly?" I ask. "Because his name was Prince?" I later look at one of the websites this person relies upon for information. On it, an anonymous source close to the royal family, a palace insider, reports hearing the Queen saying to another Illuminati member at a tea party that before the year ends, 3 more world-famous musicians must die. None of the websites my friend looks at say anything bad about Donald Trump. Rather, he is hailed as a man of peace. The ones they hate are George Soros, of course, and surprisingly Bill Gates, who has murdered more innocents than even the Clintons, apparently. My friend gets almost feverish when he talks about these people and the way they're all connected. Queen Elizabeth leads to Jay-Z, leads to the Centers for Disease Control, leads to the fake Sandy Hook shooting and the way the government staged 9/11. I want to laugh, then I want him to laugh and say, "Just kidding." But he honestly believes all this, and is frustrated that I won't believe it as well. "Wake up," he says. 5. An article in the New York Times suggests that Trump should run with the Hamburglar, and I think, hey, that's my line. 6. On election night, I am in Portland, Oregon. At the start of the evening, I feel confident, but come dinner time, I start to get nervous. I eat alone in the fancy hotel restaurant, watching the waiters and waitresses for clues that I am worrying over nothing. "Any news?" I keep asking, taking it for granted that, like me, they voted for Clinton. They have ironic tattoos and know about wine. Who else could they have been for, I think. Back in the room, I turn on the radio and look at the electoral map online. I go to bed, reach for my iPad, shut my eyes, reach for my iPad. When the election is called for Trump, I lie there, unable to sleep. In the middle of the night, I go to the fitness center and watch the little TV embedded in my elliptical machine. The news had been telling me for months that Clinton was a shoo-in. Now they want me to listen as they soul-search and determine how they got it so wrong. "Fuck you," I say to the little screen. An hour later, I take a bath and get back into bed. Staring at the ceiling, wide awake, I suddenly think of Cher and realize that what I'm feeling, she's feeling as well. So are millions of other people, of course, Hugh, my sisters, all my friends except for the conspiracy theorist. Oddly, it's this woman I've never met or even seen in person who brings me comfort. The next morning, I wander the city in a daze, my eyes bloodshot from lack of sleep, thinking, I'm not alone. I've got Cher. 7. A few days after the election, I am in Oakland, California. It's Sunday afternoon, and I notice a great many people walking toward what looks like a park, some of them carrying signs. "What's going on?" I ask a young woman. Her hair is purple in some places and green in others. "Oh," she says, "everyone's going to Lake Merritt to hold hands. We're going to form a human chain around it." She says this, as though it's going to reverse time and make Donald Trump stop being the president-elect. I cringe, thinking of how this will play on Fox News. Watch out, everyone. They're holding hands. 8. I joined my family on Emerald Isle for Thanksgiving and have a great screaming fight with my Republican father, who yells at one point, "Donald Trump is not an asshole." I find this funny, but at the same time surprising. Regardless of whether you voted for him, I thought the president-elect's identity as a despicable human being was something we could all agree on. I mean, he pretty much ran on it. Later in our argument, my father shouts, "He's the best thing that's happened to this country in years, and it was just locker room talk." I'm in locker rooms 5 days a week and have never heard anyone carry on like Trump in that video, I argue. And if I did, I wouldn't think, "Wow, that guy ought to be my president." I'd think he was a creep and a loser. Then I add, repeating something I'd heard from someone else, "Besides, he wasn't in a locker room. He was at work." Since I left the United States in 1998, I've cast absentee ballots. Americans overseas vote from the last state they lived in, which for me was New York. Then we got the house on Emerald Isle, and I changed my location to North Carolina, where I'm more inclined to feel hopeless. In 1996, in line at the grocery store in Lower Manhattan, I'd look at the people in front of me thinking, "Bill Clinton voter, Bill Clinton voter, convicted felon, Bill Clinton voter, foreign tourist, felon, felon, Bill Clinton voter, felon." At the Emerald Isle supermarket that I stomp off to after the fight with my father, it's Trump, 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 and then the cashier, who also voted for him. Of course, these are just my assumptions. The guy in the t-shirt that pictures a semi-automatic rifle above the message, "Come and take it." The one in fatigues, buying 2 12-packs of beer and a tub of rice pudding, didn't necessarily vote Republican. He could have just stayed home on election day and force-fed the women he holds captive in the crawlspace beneath his living room. The morning after our argument, I come downstairs to find my father in the kitchen. "Are you still talking to me?" he asks. I look at him as if he were single-handedly responsible for the election of Donald Trump, as if he had knowingly cast the tie-breaking vote and all of what is to come is entirely his fault. Then I say, "Yes, of course I'm still talking to you." He turns and plods into the living room. Horse's ass. 9. On Christmas morning at home in England, I climb into the loft space above the bedroom in search of some presents I'd wrapped months earlier. The ladder I'm using is wooden and has only 2 legs, which slip on my freshly waxed floor. I fall from a height of 9 feet and land with a bang on my left side, fracturing 8 ribs. As I lie on the floor, stunned and in the greatest pain of my life, it occurs to me that I might die before Trump assumes office and that maybe that won't be such a terrible thing. Amy runs out of the guest room then, and Hugh charges up the stairs from the kitchen, both of them asking, "What happened, and are you all right?" I don't want to ruin Christmas, so say, "I'm fine. I'm fine." Fine people, though, don't need 10 minutes to get off the floor. Hugh phones the NHS, the National Health Service, and after being asked a number of preliminary questions, I'm put through to a nurse named Mary. "Who are you again?" I ask. "Mary," she repeats, not, I notice, Mary Stewart or whatever her last name is. Everything in America is based on lawsuits, on establishing a trail. In the United States, I'd be told to come in immediately for x-rays, but in England, they figure that unless you're unconscious or leaking great quantities of fluid, blood, pus, etc., there's no point in wasting everyone's time. Mary asks me a number of questions to determine whether I pierced a lung, which apparently I have not. "But it really hurts when I cough," I tell her. "Well, David," she says brightly, "then my advice to you would be not to cough and to have a lovely Christmas." I later learn that what I suffered was called blunt force trauma. It's remarkably similar to how I felt after the election, as if I'd been slammed against a wall or hit by a car. Both pains persist, show no signs, in fact, of ever going away. The damage is permanent. I will never be the same as I was before the election/accident. A lovely Christmas is out of the question. Every day I lie on the floor and clutch my sides, stunned. 10. I hold on to the most unreasonable hope. The Electoral College will come to its senses and say, we can't let this happen. It will turn out that Russia tampered with our voting machines, yet nothing stops the advancing truck. On Inauguration Day, I am in Seattle. Late in the afternoon, my old friend Lynn sends me a photo of an anti-Trump sticker someone found in Japan. It's cleverly designed, three peaks that on second glance turn out to be Trump sandwiched between two Klansmen. I want to write back and say, ha, but instead, as a joke, I respond, dear Lynn, I'm sorry you're so opposed to change or too small-minded to move past your narrow assumptions. In the future, I'd appreciate your keeping things like this to yourself. David. A minute later, I send a follow-up email that says, just kidding. And it bounces back. As do the next three emails I send. She's blocked me, I realize, after 38 years of friendship. I go to bed that night and lie awake, worried that she's telling everyone I'm a Trump supporter. The news will spread, and by morning I'll be ruined. But it was just a joke, I say to myself in the dark room. A horrible, horrible joke. Why aren't you laughing? From the outside, our house on the North Carolina coast, the C-section, is nothing much to look at. It might have been designed by a 10-year-old with a ruler. That's how basic it is. Walls, roof, windows, deck. It's easy to imagine the architect putting down his crayon and shouting into the next room, I'm done! Can I watch TV now? Whenever I denigrate the place, he reminds me that it's the view that counts, the ocean we look out at. I see his point, but it's not like you have to limit yourself to one or the other. What about West Sussex, I say? From the outside, our cottage in England resembles something you'd find in a storybook, a home for pot-bellied trolls, benevolent ones that smoke pipes. Built of stone in the late 16th century, it has a pitched roof and little windows with panes the size of playing cards. We lie in bed and consider sheep grazing in the shadow of a verdant down. I especially love being there in winter, so it bothered me when I had to spend most of January and February working in the United States. Hugh came along, and toward the end we found ourselves on Maui, where I had a reading. I'd have been happy just to fly in and fly out, but Hugh likes to swim in the ocean, so we stayed for a week in a place he found online. Let me guess, the box office manager of the theater I performed at said. It's spread out over at least four levels and paneled in dark wood like something you'd see on a 1970s TV show, right? He'd hit it squarely on the nose, especially the dark part. The wood on the interior walls had been rigorously stained and was almost the color of fudge, a stark contrast to the world outside, which was relentlessly, almost oppressively bright. As for the various levels, any excuse seemed to have been taken to add stairs, even if only two or three. If you lived there full time, you'd no doubt get the hang of them. As it was, I tripped or fell down at least twice a day. The house reminded me of the condominium units my family used to rent on Emerald Isle when I was in my 20s, though none of those had a crucifix hanging in the kitchen. This one was 10 inches tall and supported a slender, miserable Christ plated in bronze. That was the only decoration, aside from a number of framed photo collages of the owner and his family taken over the years. They were a good-looking group, one that multiplied as the children grew and had kids of their own. The color in the earlier snapshots had faded, just as it has in pictures of my own family. Same haircuts, same flared slacks and shirts with long droopy collars, only now drained of their vibrancy, like lawns in winter. Each generation looked healthy and prosperous, yet I found myself wondering what lurked beneath the surface, for surely there was something. "Which of you is in prison now?" I'd ask, glancing up as I tripped on the stairs to the bedroom. The house was on the ocean, and the beach that began where the backyard ended was shaded with palms. Most often it was deserted, so except for a few short trips up the coast for supplies, Hugh stayed put during our week on Maui. If he wasn't on the deck overlooking the water, he was in the water, looking back at the deck. He saw whales and sea turtles. He snorkeled. My only accomplishment was to sign my name to 5,000 blank sheets of paper sent by my publisher, tip-ins, they're called. A month or two down the line, they'd be bound into copies of the book I had just about finished. There were still a few more weeks to make changes, but they could only be minor grammatical things. Hugh, who is good at spotting typos and used to do so for his father, a novelist, was reading the manuscript for the first time. Whenever I heard him laugh, I'd ask, "What's so funny?" Should 5 or 10 minutes pass with no reaction, I'd call out, "Why aren't you laughing?" It takes quite a while to sign your name 5,000 times, so I set myself a daily goal and would stop whatever I was doing every 2 hours and pick up my magic marker. Often, while autographing, I'd listen to the radio or watch a TV show I like called Intervention. In it, real-life alcoholics and drug addicts are seen going about their business. Most are too far gone to hold down jobs, so mainly we see them starting fights, crying on unmade beds, and shooting up in hard-to-spot places like the valleys between their toes. Amazing to me is that anyone would allow him or herself to be filmed in this condition. "Did you catch me on TV?" I'd imagine them saying to their friends. "Wasn't it incredible when I shit on that car?" That's what a 31-year-old drunk woman did in one of the episodes I watched as I signed blank sheets of paper, pulled down her pants, positioned herself just so, and defecated on the rear bumper of a parked Audi A4. As she went at it, a diamond shape blurring her from the waist down, I thought of my mother, in part because she was a lady. By this I mean that she never wore pants, just skirts and dresses. She never left the house without makeup on and her hair styled. Whenever I see a young woman boarding a plane in her pajamas or a guy in a T-shirt that reads, "Your hole is my goal," I always wonder what Mom would think. She's been dead for almost 30 years, so she missed a lot of the build-up to what is now thought of as less than scandalous behavior. I once watched a show in which a group of young men were sent out to collect pubic hair. It was a contest of sorts. And in the end, the loser had to put all the spoils on a pizza and eat it. That was in 2003, so to me, someone on television shitting on a car, sure, okay, that makes sense. To go there straight from murder, she wrote, however, would be quite a shock. Another reason Intervention makes me think about my mother is that she was an alcoholic. It's a hard word to use for someone you love, and so my family avoided it. Rather, we'd whisper among ourselves that Mom had a problem, that she could stand the cutback. Sober, she was cheerful and charismatic, the kind of person who could and would talk to anyone. Unlike our father, who makes jokes no one understands and leaves his listeners baffled and eager to get away, it was fun to hear what our mom might come out with. "I got them laughing," was a popular line in the stories she'd tell at the end of the day. The men who pumped her gas, the bank tellers, the receptionists at the dentist's office, I got them laughing. Her specialty was the real-life story, perfected and condensed. These take work, and she'd go through a half dozen verbal drafts before getting one where she wanted it. Over the course of the day, the line she wished she'd delivered in response to some question or comment, the zinger, would become the line she had delivered. "So I said to him, 'Buddy, that's why they invented the airplane.'" We'd be on the sidelines aghast. That's not how it happened at all. But what did it matter with such great results? You'd think my mother could have seen the difference between the sunny, likable her and the dark one who'd call late at night. I could hear the ice cubes in her glass rushing forth whenever she took a sip. In my youth, when she joined my father for a drink after work, just one, I have to get dinner on the table, that was a happy sound. Now it was like a trigger being cocked. "The little bitch," my mother would say, her voice slipping.